I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. In the first hour of the show today, a quick look back at the top political stories of 2014, and then a full look ahead at what to expect in 2015. Following their stunning gains in the midterm elections, Republicans now control Congress. What will President Obama be able to accomplish in his last 2 years in office? In Maryland, Republican Governor-elect Larry Hogan takes over January 21st. What does this mean for the future of the Red Line, the environment, and state spending on education? Plus, are we headed for a Clinton-Bush rematch for the White House in 2016? The political year in review and ahead after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us, making Midday part of your day. In this hour, we look back at the biggest political stories of 2014. It's Midday Politics, and then we take a full look ahead at what to expect in 2015 and 2016, which, of course, is a presidential election year. We're joined by Melissa Deckman of Washington College, where she is chair of the Political Science Department and joins us here from time to time on Midday. Melissa, nice to see you again.
Nice to be here.
And back with us on Midday is Donald F. Norris. Don Norris is a director of the Center for Public Policy, the School for Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, longtime political analyst of Maryland politics and national politics. Don Norris, nice to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. I haven't had a chance to talk to you. I've talked to Melissa a couple of times since the November election, so I'm curious to get your take on what happened there. Larry Hogan's big upset of Anthony Brown in the governor's race in Maryland and the Republicans taking over the two houses of the Congress.
Right, right. Well, you're probably familiar with the Don Norris rule, since I tell everybody what the Don Norris rule is. It's in Maryland, if a good Democratic candidate running a good campaign wins a statewide election against a good Republican running a good campaign every time. So what we had this time was a problem with both the candidate and the campaign on the Democratic side. Anthony Brown ran a horrible campaign. He did not present himself as a good candidate, didn't sell himself at all. And he kept attacking Hogan, which gave Hogan name recognition that he didn't previously have. And Hogan had the narrative. Maryland has high taxes. Maryland has bad regulation, yada, yada, yada. And he continued with that narrative throughout the campaign. And it stuck, and nothing Brown could do would unstick it. Further, Brown ran away from the 8 years of the O'Malley-Brown administration and a lot of really good things that happened during that period of time. So that's what happened, in my view.
I want to ask you about this. Some people said that there was O'Malley-Brown fatigue. After 8 years, people just want to change, want somebody else in the governor's mansion. So I raised the question, I think I asked Melissa about this once, does a lieutenant governor, does someone who serves as a lieutenant governor in Maryland have any chance of being elected governor, especially if you serve two terms as lieutenant governor and you're associated with a person that the public is might be tired of?
Well, I think in this particular case, the answer is obviously no.
No,
but,
in this case.
But again, I think it's because of the campaign that he ran, which was a terrible campaign. I've heard people say it was worse than Kathleen Kennedy Townsend's, and I'm tending to agree with that because he had so much more money to spend, mm-hmm. which he just wasted. It was a Republican year nationwide, so Hogan clearly benefited from that. There was some O'Malley fatigue, and he benefited from that as well. But still, the registration in this state is so overwhelmingly Democratic that if Brown had done what I think could have been done,
yeah,
he wouldn't have won by 14 points. He probably wouldn't have won by six, but he would have won by two or three.
Okay. Larry Hogan had a consistent message throughout the campaign.
Absolutely.
And now he has to govern. January 21st, he becomes governor. So we might as well start there. Why don't we just talk about things here in Maryland? And by the way, folks, you can join us this hour if you want to talk some politics, you have some observations or questions about Larry Hogan, about to become governor of Maryland next month, the outgoing governor, Martin O'Malley. You might have some comments about him. I'd like to hear from Melissa and Don about Martin O'Malley's presidential ambitions. Also, Ben Carson, speaking of another Marylander who's
Well, he's not so much talking about running for president, but other people want Ben Carson to run for president on the Republican side. We've got that to talk about.
And Bob Ehrlich.
And Bob Ehrlich, his name has also been thrown in there. So give us a call if you want to talk about any of that during this hour of Midday Politics, 410-662-8780. So, Melissa, you've been watching the Larry Hogan transition a bit here. There'll be more of it the next few weeks, more cabinet secretaries being announced. And then we get to his inauguration January 21st. So you have to sort of move the rhetoric from running for office to actually governing from the office, right?
No, absolutely. I agree with Don. I think that Larry Hogan ran a really strong campaign. What was interesting about Hogan's campaign, though, is that while constantly critiquing the O'Malley administration and talking about taxes and fatigue about taxes, he was very smart in not actually making specific promises. If you look at his language, it was always, well, we want to roll back as many of these taxes as we can. We talked about the much-hated rain tax, all of these sorts of things. But he never actually specifically said, once I'm in office, I'm going to repeal that. And I think he realized that he's got a big, large budget deficit to deal with, a structural deficit. And so it's going to be, I think, potentially a contentious session, because there are going to be some real budget cuts that have to happen. And now we're going to see, you know, where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. What are his priorities in terms of being a governor? Because I think, you know, it's going to be a big challenge.
That structural deficit, Don Norris, we've been hearing about that for years through several governors.
Yes.
Yeah, it's still there.
Yes.
Larry Hogan has to deal with it now.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's because the General Assembly can't not spend. That's the problem. These guys and gals get elected, and they want to get reelected. So how do you get reelected? You bring the bacon home.
Mm-hmm.
And bacon costs money. And so you have these rosy scenarios about what the budget revenue picture is going to look like next year. And it never quite looks that way. And so you dig yourself a hole that you can't get out of year after year after year. So it'll be interesting to see if Hogan can rein in that spending a bit. Now, the situation this year is made more complex, more difficult, because we are really the recipient of a deficit thanks to the federal government not spending the kind of money in the state that we had anticipated would be spent. So it's both a structural deficit and a deficit brought on by unforeseen events.
So there was the recession effects, there was the federal budget sequester effects, and now we have not as much spending generally from the federal government.
That's correct.
So that's one thing. So when Larry Hogan gets to Annapolis, what does he face there? I just wanted to note here that the General Assembly had some gains, too, in that election. The Republicans picked up 9 seats in the House of Delegates, 2 in the Senate. The Republicans will have 52 seats in the 141-seat House now. So, and, you know, I listened to Larry Hogan, and he sounds a lot like Mike Miller, the Senate president, who is pretty conservative, even though a Democrat. Those two probably have some affinity. They probably hear each other's Nightingale song a little bit, so to speak. So, I mean, what does it look like when he goes down there to Annapolis? What is he facing in terms of the Democrats?
I would say that he's got a lot of good opportunities in the sense that there's also massive turnover, not just new Republicans, but new Democrats coming in. And so I think that, you know, he's going to have a brand new set of legislators who are looking for some guidance. And I think there's a lot of good public will for Larry Hogan. He's been smart in tapping a very moderate cabinet I'm looking for. He tapped Joe Getty, who's a legislator, to be basically his chief lobbyist, and Bobby Neal, who's a friend of Mike Miller, to help with some of the political consulting and his administration. So he's been very centrist in his approach. And so I think, you know, initially, people are pretty pleased with who he's tapping. Again, once the decisions have to come in terms of making budget cuts, though, that's when you're going to see a lot more political fireworks.
Yes,
absolutely. So far, so good. He looks like he's about to govern, whereas his predecessor, his Republican predecessor, Bob Ehrlich, never governed. Bob Ehrlich fought with the General Assembly the entire time he was in office, and he lost virtually everything that he put forward, or the Democrats molded it in their own fashion. I think if Hogan is smart, and I think he is, he will understand that he cannot do that and have a second term. If he governs, if he cooperates, if he compromises, without giving up his main, you know, his central principles, then I think he's going to be rewarded by cooperation from the Democrats and very likely rewarded by a second term. On the other hand, if he doesn't do that, it's over before it begins.
Okay, so I have a question then. What do voters expect? Those who voted for Larry Hogan, Republicans, independents, or even Democrats. I know a lot of Democrats who voted for Larry Hogan. What do you expect? Are you expecting a tax cut? Do you expect Larry Hogan to go down there and call for the repeal of the stormwater remediation fee plan that was put in place a couple of years ago that they ridicule as the rain tax? Are you expecting those things? And would that be the test for you whether you vote for him 4 years from now? Don Norris, you lay out something that's very reasonable for the moderate person, you know, who thinks both sides have something to offer, right? But there are others who will say, wait a minute, I thought he was going to cut taxes, right? Or I thought, how about the gasoline tax? O'Malley administration raised that. Isn't Larry Hogan going to cut that? Of course, Melissa, as you said, he didn't make any promises, but he sure sounded like he was going to try to reduce taxes.
I think this is what he's counting on. I think that for the first year, I think the Maryland public is going to give him somewhat of a pass because there really are big holes in the budget, and there is a sense that we have to work on this together to get through it. I think at the end of 4 years, if there isn't substantial tax relief, then I think he's going to be open to criticism. So that's what I would be looking for, you know, in the next year and 4 years down the road. I think what Hogan is counting on is that there will be an effort to reduce business taxes to spur business development, and that I think is a legitimate claim that he made against the O'Malley administration. Look, Don's absolutely right. The federal government wields a large stick in Maryland economics, and so this is something that we have to deal with. There's going to be changes. There's less federal spending. So we have to come up with a plan to try to spur economic development and to use Maryland's sort of highly educated workforce to its betterment. And so that's really what his plan is to try to spur economic development. So we'll have to see.
I think that's absolutely right. It's going to be interesting, though, to see when he starts cutting taxes and what taxes he starts to cut, and whether the Democrats will actually go along with him on some of those taxes. The Democrats, prior to the election, had begun talking about tax relief. If you remember the Sauerbrey-Glendening election in 1994, where Glendening won by only
barely,
you know, 6,000
votes.
Yeah. Immediately, he and the leaders of the General Assembly adopted a plan to reduce the state income tax by 10% over 4 years. He won resounding re-election.
Larry Hogan, in an interview with the Washington Post, said that cuts will be necessary in the coming years in state support of K through 12 education, universities and colleges, and health care for the poor. At a news conference in Annapolis, I think this was last week, on November 4th, the people of Maryland rejected massive spending increases and tax increases and a failing economy. Larry Hogan said, we'll have to have the courage to say no. Say no to what? Say no to the red line. Say no to K through pre-K education, which was something that Anthony Brown had said that he was supporting and others in the legislature have said that were supporting. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Why don't we take our first break in this hour, and we'll come back and talk some more with Don Norris from University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where he is director of the School for Public Policy, and Melissa Deckman, chair of the Political Science Department at Washington College. So what's ahead for Obama and the Congress, too? We'll talk about that. President Obama looking at his last 2 years in office with the Republicans in charge of both the House and the Senate. 410-662-8780 is our number here. Open phone lines for Midday Politics. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Midday Politics. Dan Rodrigues here with Melissa Deckman from Washington College and Don Norris from the University of Maryland at Baltimore County. UMBC was founded in the mid-1960s, and the School for Public Policy is about 40 years old.
40
right?
years old this
he
year.
He had an anniversary.
Yes, we did.
Congratulations on that, Don.
Thank you.
I mentioned the red line before we went took our break. Red line, the purple line, Larry Hogan putting up his hands and saying, wait, I'm not sure about this, whether the state can contribute for the construction of these light rail systems. And there is federal money available. It's been approved. A lot of the plans have been approved already. This has been in the making for at least 10 years, I think. Going on 10 years anyway. So what happens here with Larry Hogan and the red line question?
Well, if he follows through his campaign rhetoric, he will say no to the red line. He will say no to the purple line. He will really, really annoy the Baltimore business community because the Baltimore business community has been steadfast supporters of the red line.
Mm-hmm.
He will annoy a number of people in Montgomery County, though he probably doesn't worry about that too much because he's not going to get a lot of votes out of Montgomery County if he kills the purple line. The thing I think that he has to bear in mind, and I'm sure he and his advisors will bear this in mind, that while they will have to say no in this period of budget cutting, they have to be careful how many times they say no, over what they say no, and to whom they say no, because they could create a firestorm that would bring his governorship down in 4 years.
Melissa, what about that? You see no expansion to government in any form during the... I mentioned pre-K before we went off, took our break, too. If we don't see pre-K under Hogan, do we see the red line? Do we see any expansion of government?
Well, I think with the public transportation, one of the things that Hogan was clear about going throughout the state is that he's not a big proponent of public transportation. I mean, he's more interested in building roads, repairing roads, and his voter base came from many rural areas and from suburban areas, and people who don't use public transportation.
Right.
So I think that for the first year or two, you're not going to see much movement there. I personally think it's a little penny wise and pound foolish, right? Because you need to be investing in this. In terms of
and it just gets more expensive
the
longer you
and
wait,
you leave
right?
money on the table, right? In fact, there's already
Federal
been
money.
Tens of millions of dollars have been spent,
yeah.
at least with respect to the purple line. So,
right.
But I don't see him in doing much with that, you know, at least not this year. Whether he grows government, you know, he ran as a conservative economic sort of philosophy that essentially the free market should be doing these sorts of things. There's too much government investment. But I think Don's right in that Maryland voters have come to expect a certain level of service and I think if you say no too many times, it really could hurt him in the future.
Hey, what about the Republican Party in Maryland, Don? When Robert Ehrlich was elected, some people thought, well, it's possible we'll see a resurgence or in the Republican Party. You know, people moving from independent to Republican, people moving even from the Democratic Party to Republican when Bob Ehrlich was in office. And that didn't happen, actually. The biggest growth was in Democrats and or independents. I can't remember which one.
Independents.
Was
Democrats.
It independent growth? So what about with Larry Hogan here? Do you see any surge in Republican registration?
We haven't so far.
I mean could you predict see it? Is
well,
it possible?
I think it depends. Bob Ehrlich didn't do anything to grow the party while he was governor. I think Hogan has a chance to do that. And I think there is a latent demand out there among independents and among conservative Democrats that if they see that the possibility is that the Republican Party could be a viable organization in the state and not, you know, off on the margin as it has been for so long,
mm-hmm.
that people will begin moving in that direction. We could have a two-party state. If he's in office 4 years, probably not much of a chance. If he's in office 8 years and controls redistricting—
That's right.
Then,
yeah,
then
the governor gets to do that.
Then the card game. Then the card game changes phenomenally.
I think it's also notable, and really, I think this bodes well for the Republican Party in Maryland. If you look at county exec races, we now have, and I think you had on your show recently, Barry Glassman, Harford County Executive, mm-hmm. Alan Kittleman, out in Howard County,
and then there's Steve Hsu in
and Steve
Anne Arundel
Hsu in my own
county,
where I live in Anne Arundel,
mm-hmm.
and I think these are sort of the classic moderate to conservative, center right Republicans that tend to do well in a state like Maryland, and I think if they leave office with a successful record, and they're also what is notable about them as compared to, say, the Tea Party, is that they believe there's a role for government to play, especially in spurring economic development. And you see this in all three candidates talking about the role of government helping to foster growth. And I think if they're successful in stewarding their counties, one, it gives the GOP a much bigger bench later on.
Absolutely.
But it could potentially, essentially, make the GOP a viable second party in the state of Maryland, where it hasn't really been that way until now.
Well, and it also produces at least three potential candidates for governor in 8 years.
I was just going to say that. There's a Republican bench now in terms of that. What about on the Democratic side? There's Kevin Kamenetz, a Baltimore County executive.
Whom I hear is highly rumored to be seeking the governor's the governor's office.
Yeah. By the way, he was in here a couple of weeks ago and wasn't so hot about the red line. Actually, was very critical of a bill that was sent to Baltimore County for their part in it that he didn't expect. And doesn't think the system makes sense physically, the way it's designed. So he went into all that. Now, I don't know how much that might influence the decision in Annapolis, but it seems to me that the red line needs as much support as it can get if the governor himself is opposed, the new governor, the governor-elect is opposed to it. You would need to line up as many duckies as you can in the areas affected by the red line in order to make that happen. 410-662-8780. Bill in Catonsville had a comment or a question about the stormwater fee that others call a rain tax. Hello, Bill.
Can you hear me okay? I'm speaking from a car phone. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, that's fine, Bill. What's your question or comment?
Okay, so do either of the guests or do you understand how the rain tax or whatever the official name is, how it has an impact on the budget? Do you have an understanding of that?
I don't think it affects the state budget. It's a mandate through the legislature that went out to Baltimore City and the nine largest jurisdictions after that, the nine largest counties after that, to come up with a plan to meet the Environmental Protection Agency goals on arresting filthy stormwater that rushes into gutters, into creeks, into the bay. And then each of the counties have to set, and the city has to set a fee, if that's necessary, to fund these projects that go into arresting stormwater. So I don't know that it affects the state budget specifically, Bill. Is that what your question is?
Well, that is my question.
Yeah.
I guess to follow up, other than Maryland, are any other states participating in this program?
I don't know. I don't know
the
if
states,
it's a state.
The states of Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York are affected by the EPA ruling. I don't know how they are handling it, but yes, they're affected in the same way that Maryland is affected.
We've had some programs here about the stormwater efforts, stormwater arrest efforts in Pennsylvania. So I don't know if it came from the legislature, how they're handling it there. I can't say. But, you know, this controversy here, this is a, I don't know, to me it's a relatively small amount of money that people are asked for. Businesses are asked for money based on the amount of impervious surface that they have that stormwater runs off on. And each county was given the power to decide how to implement this.
But I think symbolically it's important, right? I think Republicans were very savvy in calling this our rain tax, right? And those were some very effective commercials and complaining about the O'Malley administration that he even has the audacity to tax the rain. And that's really not what's going on. It's a little more complicated than that. But it kind of reminds me of what the GOP did with the inheritance tax, right, in the 1990s.
The death tax.
Which was broadly popular by most American accounts. And then it became a death tax. And so all of a sudden people's attitudes about it began to change.
They even used the Obamacare. They associated the Affordable Care Act with Obama. People don't like Obamacare, but they love the ACA, according to the surveys that we see.
Yes, absolutely.
Don Norris from the UMBC and Melissa Deckman from Washington College. It's Midday Politics. 410-662-8780 is a number. Let's talk about the outgoing governor, Martin O'Malley, who's leaving office, having spent a good amount of time in the last couple of years sort of campaigning for president, appearing on national television quite a bit, serving as president of the Democratic Governors Association, which got him a lot of national attention for a period there through the recession. He's been to Iowa a lot. He's been to New Hampshire. He's been to South Carolina campaigning for others. So let me go to you on this. You said you recently at the 40th anniversary of UMBC's school of public policy that you heard what sounded like a stump speech from Martin O'Malley.
Yeah, so the governor came out. He gave the keynote talk at our 40th anniversary. It was very gracious of him to do that, and we really appreciated it. And clearly that was one of the speeches that he's using in Iowa, in New Hampshire, and elsewhere. It went over very well with our students.
What did it sound like? Can you give us a sense of it?
Well, part of it had to do with, it was really very clever, actually. The first part of the speech had to do with income inequality. And he went back to the 1970s. Have you heard the speech, Melissa?
I have not heard the speech.
He went back to the 1970s in terms of where the various quintiles, you know, the top 20%, the middle and the bottom and so on and so forth, and where they stood with respect to one another and what their income was. And then beginning in the 80s, with all the tax cuts that favored the wealthy and harmed the middle class, he had students hold up placards as to where they stood in 1979 and then where they stood in 2010, had them walk across the stage. And you could see the inequality, the income inequality, getting worse and worse, more severe and
more severe.
You mean
larger numbers of people in the lower quintile?
Yes, and fewer people making far more money at the top.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
He demonstrated that on the stage. He had all this sort of choreographed.
Yes, he did.
That's
he did. It was very clever. And then he discussed the particular policies that had been proposed and adopted by Congress that resulted in that inequality. And then he turned the tables over to governmental management. And it was really fascinating because he went into all the kinds of things that he has done in Baltimore City as mayor and in the state to better manage government. So we've got income inequality because of bad policy, but we can do something about that if we manage government properly. Mm-hmm.
He didn't mention the health insurance exchange, did he, by any chance?
He did not.
Because, I mean, that was a pretty – that was the low point, I think, for the O'Malley administration with all their vaunted use of technology and information technology to keep track of things. CityStat in Baltimore City and then BayStat, the Chesapeake Bay, when he got in, became governor. And, you know, we talked about this, Melissa, when it happened, when it was happening last year, the rollout of the health insurance exchange.
It was a disaster.
And Herb Smith from McDaniel College said, you know, if you're the party of government, the party that supports government,
you can't let stuff like this happen.
You have to govern.
That's right.
To make government work. And that's interesting. The governor was there because that is the school of public policy. But he sounded like he's running for president. Now, let's talk about the politics of that a little bit.
Well, I think that most Democrats are expecting and wanting a Hillary Clinton candidacy. And until that has been solved, I think that he's really in limbo. If Hillary Clinton decides not to run, which I don't think is going to be the case, then it kind of opens up maybe some opportunities for O'Malley. But simply put, most Americans have no idea who he is. And so
that's really what he has to contend with. Let me mention three names to you. Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Americans didn't know who they were either. So I think just because O'Malley is a relative unknown doesn't rule him out at all.
Mm-hmm. I give Obama one thing, though, on your I agree with you on this, because no one knew who Jimmy Carter was. Jimmy who? Bill Clinton. He gave a long speech once, didn't he, at a convention?
At the
Democratic National Convention. People thought it was over.
They thought his career was over.
His speech was too long. Yeah. O'Malley gave a speech at a Democratic convention that didn't go over so well either. But Barack Obama, I will say,
he did. He gave
2004,
it.
2004,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Red states, blue states.
Yes.
Launched his political career.
Yeah,
it was brilliant.
He rolled out. It was a breakout speech for him. So I'll give him that. Okay, but only 1% of the voters know who he is, mm-hmm. according to the Gallup poll, or the ABC Washington Post poll.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't think that's a big deal now?
I agree with Melissa. If Hillary Clinton runs, everybody else is off the table, and Martin is clearly running for lieutenant governor.
What does he do? You mean vice president?
I said lieutenant governor.
Whoa, lieutenant governor.
We were just
Maryland
talking about lieutenant governor, weren't
yeah.
we?
Yeah.
That was a faux pas.
Yeah.
Yes. If he continues running, then it becomes clear that he's running for vice president.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If that doesn't happen, because I'm trying to imagine Hillary Clinton selecting him, I guess that's possible. But what if that doesn't happen? What happens to Martin O'Malley between now and 2020, say? If he preserves these presidential ambitions, because he mm-hmm. wouldn't be the first person to have to put off running for president for a few years. Ronald Reagan did it, right, after he was governor of California.
He was also a gazillionaire at the time.
Who, Ronald Reagan?
Yes.
Yeah, he had made a lot of
he had made a lot of money
from speeches and television and whatnot.
That's
and the
right.
movies. But what happens to Martin O'Malley between now and then if this doesn't happen in 2016?
My guess is he might go into some sort of consulting, or he might start some sort of public policy research. He is a wonk at heart,
absolutely.
At the end of the day.
He is.
I mean,
absolutely.
Martin
yeah.
O'Malley is a policy wonk, and so I wouldn't be surprised if he starts some sort of progressive policy organization to really put more attention on things like income inequality or immigration reform or policies where he's really tried to be out in front of the other Democrats. The other problem that O'Malley faces is that you have sort of among progressive Democrats the rise of Elizabeth Warren. Do I think Elizabeth Warren is going to win the nomination? Not at this point.
If she does win the nomination, I don't think she can win the presidency.
But I think that's sort of his competition within the party, because I think he is trying to become sort of the more progressive part of a leader within the Democratic Party, because Hillary is really more of a centrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Hillary Clinton is banking on.
A progressive and not from Massachusetts, which
Correct.
Is the problem with Elizabeth Warren, the fact that she would be a liberal from Massachusetts. But look at what she's talking about, Dawn Norris. Just last week or the week before, she's all over the news complaining about the Democrats, her own party, making concessions to Wall Street again.
That's right.
A rollback of the Dodd-Frank law. So, and you know, some people in the Tea Party, I don't know if they would ever endorse or gravitate toward Elizabeth Warren, but there's some affinity there in terms of their regard for Wall Street.
That's correct.
You don't think that could work in the long term for someone running for office?
I don't see the Tea Party folks voting for Elizabeth Warren.
I guess not.
Not
okay.
anytime soon. No.
It's an interesting connection to think about, though. 410-662-8780 is our number here. So we expect Hillary to make an announcement. I keep reading different things, that she'd have to make an announcement that she's not going to run, if that were the case, pretty soon, in order to give others in the party a shot.
I think that's correct,
right?
Yeah.
So you get into January 2015, February at the latest for an announcement that she's not running. But looking at strategy, if she's going to run, can she still take her time?
Well, you know, the downside of announcing too early is that all of a sudden we have all these stories reminding us why lots of Americans don't like Hillary Clinton, right? Yeah. So people tend to like her when she's not running for president, right? She was a fairly popular Secretary of State. Not to say she was perfect, but certainly fairly popular. But what's interesting is that the poll numbers had her at a high approval rating of about almost 70% for a while. Latest polls show the American public gave her at about 60% because she's going to be tied into Barack Obama and so and his administration.
And Benghazi, so let's not forget Benghazi.
Well, right. And so yeah. I think that it benefits her to maybe hold off on making an announcement for running for president.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. The longer she holds out, the less of an attack can get started on her. Because
right.
Melissa's absolutely right. The moment that she announces, it's going to be a free-for-all of attacks coming from the right, coming from the Republican Party for the entire period of time that she's running.
And Benghazi, you mentioned Benghazi a couple of times there. I'm sure Republicans will mention it a lot. Even though we had a bipartisan report from Congress saying it's not what it looked like, some of these conspiracy theories are just not credible.
Ironically, right? Tens of millions of dollars spent on investigating, which is essentially the same conclusion.
But if you say something long enough and loudly enough, regardless of the evidence, enough people will believe it to be scary.
Who are you supporting? Do you think Hillary Clinton will run for office? Are you going to support her? Is there any other choice on the Democratic side? 410-662-8780. Dan Roderick's here with Melissa Deckman from Washington College and Don Norris from UMBC. If you'd like to join our conversation, have a comment or question. I got some Mitch McConnell quotes to share about governing as the Republicans take over control of the Senate in January, and what is President Obama's last 2 years in office going to look like. You're welcome to join us. If not, just stay tuned and listen to some more of our political analysis as we look ahead to 2015 and 2016. This is Midday. A short break. We'll be right back. Frank in Hampstead writes, I am frankly amazed by this Obama 2.0 that has appeared after the midterm. I wonder where this Obama has been during the last 6 years. I know it certainly has thrown Republicans for a loop. After all, according to their playbook, he should just slink back into the White House and sign whatever Republicans send in the form of bills. This supercharged Obama, I believe, has finally arrived at the conclusion that he will never get help from Republicans for anything, and he must therefore flex his presidential muscle and accomplish what he can on his own. This is certainly going to cause heartburn for the Republican Party and even for the Democratic Party. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the President Obama's record just for the last couple of weeks before his vacation, there seems to be some fire there. The reach out to Cuba, just one example of that.
Well, I think a lot of people have written off Barack Obama, but you have to look at history, recent history. Ronald Reagan, at this point in his presidency, had similar approval ratings. And so many people look back to Reagan's presidency as being a seminal one and being successful. And so to say that Obama can accomplish nothing in the next 2 years, I think is really premature. The question will he be a George W. Bush, who never was able to recover from the unpopularity of the Iraq War and also the economy going into the tank toward his last year in office? But what I think is in Obama's favor is that many of the policies that he has been arguing for have broad public support, right? And so that's one thing. And secondly, there is some indication that the economy is slightly improving.
It's actually trending the other way than it was during Bush's time.
And for the first time, it looks like there, in fact, is making some headway in terms of wage growth. Now, is this sustainable? Is this actually a trend that will bode well for 2016 for the Democrats? I'm not necessarily sure. But to say that his presidency is washed up, it's really very premature.
Don?
Absolutely. But it all depends upon which Barack Obama shows up. If the Barack Obama that we've seen for 6 years shows up, then the Democrats, then the Republicans are going to steal his lunch and they're going to eat it right in front of him.
Well, I think Frank's point is that we're seeing something different.
We are seeing something different, but is that just a short-term phenomenon,
right?
Or is he going to continue to be the tough guy and stand up to the Republicans and say, if you can't work with me, I'm going to do it without you?
Speaking of Republicans, let me just share with you some quotes from Mitch McConnell, Senator McConnell, who is headed to be the Senate Majority Leader. And talking here in the New York Times about the need to govern and not just be the party of no, and to get some of his fellow Republicans, such as Ted Cruz, people who are conditioned to saying no, getting them to say yes to some things, right? Mitch McConnell says, one of my challenges is to try to convince some of my members that passing an appropriations bill is a good thing, not a bad thing. Okay, there's Mitch McConnell. Here he is again. There are two kinds of people in politics, those who want to make a point and those who want to make a difference. How do you like that? That's from Mitch McConnell, too, the senator no of all these past years. All of us from time to time make a point, but it is time now to make a difference. Mitch McConnell, you like this? I mean, this guy is the personification of opposition to the president, right? The man who wanted to make Barack Obama a one-term president. And there's another choice quote here. Mr. McConnell has already announced that the first bill Senate Republicans put on the floor will be one expediting the Keystone XL pipeline, which fell one vote short of the 60 required to pass in a post-election push last month. So now he has to wheel and deal a bit, Mitch McConnell. It was just amusing to hear him talk about how things are different now because they're in charge of
somebody.
Of the Senate.
Somebody once said that politics gives hypocrisy a bad name.
And
in this particular case,
isn't that great?
We've got a huge amount of hypocrisy going on.
But here's another one. You'll like this to your point, Don. Mr. McConnell has no regrets and makes no apologies. He says it was Democrats who froze Republicans out and employed the Senate more as a political platform than a legislative one. Quote, it was not about legislation. It had nothing to do with an outcome. The Senate basically didn't do squat for years. I don't think most members of the Senate wanted it run that way. But he had a lot to do with it, did he not?
Okay. He did.
All right. Just thought I would share that with you now. As the Republicans move in charge of the Senate, and, of course, they have a majority in the House.
A bigger majority in the House.
And I will say this about Mitch McConnell. I mean, at the end of the day, he's an establishment Republican, and I think he really does want to govern. As the leader of the Republicans in the Senate for many years, he obviously had to be the face of opposition to Barack Obama. Some stories actually suggest, though, that he has a much better working relationship with Obama than John Boehner does. And so I think there might be some move to compromise between Mitch McConnell and between Obama. But McConnell sees the future. He knows that demographically the Republican Party has some problems, right? We have a very diverse country, Latinos, African-Americans, single mothers. They tend to trend Democratic. And I think he realizes that the GOP has to have something that's a little bit more, not being the party of no, as he says.
Right.
There has to be some policies that can maybe attract more voters. The problem he faces, of course, is that he's got some members of his own caucus who are want to run for president and have no interest in trying to govern.
Right.
Their interests are really about the next presidential election and fostering their own agenda.
Well, we got to talk about the Republican field, the likely Republican field of presidential candidates. Let's take another call. Before that, back on the Democratic side, Mary in Beltsville with a comment or question. Welcome to Midday, Mary. Mary there? Oh, maybe we lost her. Okay. But on the Republican side then, we've been hearing a lot about Jeb Bush recently. So want to talk about this a little bit. Rand Paul, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio.
I think the field is still very wide open, and there's still a big debate among Republicans themselves about who should be controlling the party. I think what Jeb Bush does, though, is it really he will become, if he does run for office, the establishment candidate. And I think a lot of old money will go into a Bush candidacy because they have a huge Rolodex. And I think some of the more moderate candidates, people like Chris Christie, I think the wind might come out of their sails a bit, or like Scott Walker out in Wisconsin. There's still a big debate among the far right of the party. Is it Rand Paul? Is it Ted Cruz? Ben Carson, who we've mentioned here before, who I don't really think has a chance of winning, but certainly could, I think, upend the field, at least in Iowa in some of the early races in 2016, if he decides to run.
It upends the effort to get toward the middle a little bit?
Yeah, no, I think it does.
For the Republican Party not to be seen as such an extreme party and appealing to those demographics that you described?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Don Norris, what do you think?
Well, I think the extreme right wing of the party runs the party these days. And I think moderates don't have a chance of succeeding in a primary. I mean, it could very well be that Jeb Bush comes in second or third regularly, but second or third doesn't get him enough delegates. I don't know how a centrist or a moderate conservative like Bush is able to get past the primary voters of the Republican Party, mm-hmm. who vote very, very, very conservatively.
On issues, and they are hot-button issues. Yesterday, we were speaking with Dallas Dance, who's the superintendent of Baltimore County Schools, about Common Core. It just happened to be a story in USA Today yesterday about Common Core dividing the likely Republican presidential field. You know, Jeb Bush is... he supports Common Core, the new standards for education in the country that have come through the Governors Association.
It's not a federal push.
But they're presenting it as one.
Exactly.
This is federal overreach, federal intrusion into what should be states' decision-making.
As if No Child Left Behind was not.
Yeah, right, right, which came in under George W. Bush. So you have that kind of thing. So that keeps a centrist or a moderate out of from winning in the primaries, the issues like that.
Issues like that and all of the other touchstone issues that the Republican right wing is so fond so fond of.
And Jeb Bush, of course, has been very moderate on immigration. And I think that immigration is one of those touchstone
issues. It's another one, yeah.
He's, in fact, refused to really sort of recant or moderate his position. He said,
Correct.
No, we need to look forward. We need to have more common sense immigration policies mm-hmm. and reform. Of course, coming from a state like Florida, married to a Latina, I think he has a different perspective on that issue.
But he is precisely the kind of Republican that, I don't think this is too strong a statement, that could, in fact, save the party from itself.
Or but I think he could certainly win,
I think
election.
I think he
absolutely.
Could. Where I think most of the rest of the guys, and they're all guys in the Republican Party, who are running or are likely to run, can't win because they're too extreme.
Mm-hmm. If they were running against Hillary.
If they were running against Hillary or Martin O'Malley or any number of other Democrats.
Huh. Ben Carson, we ought to just talk about this for a minute. It so happens that the New York Times decided to devote a story to him with the headline, GOP Hopes for Unity May Be Upset by Ben Carson. Of course, the retired pediatric neurosurgeon from Johns Hopkins, who has said a lot of pretty extreme things since he went on television as a Fox commentator. He's left that now and has a new book out, has been doing a bus tour around the country, and there's a Run, Ben, Run campaign out there that is gaining traction, apparently. This is a quote from the New York Times piece. With former Governor Jeb Bush of Florida moving closer to declaring his candidacy and the Republican establishment determined not to repeat the mistakes of the lengthy nominating fight of 2012, the rise of Mr. Carson suggests the best laid plans of the party for 2016 may not go as smoothly as desired.
You can't be elected president by calling the current administration or comparing it to Nazi Germany. That's just not going to happen. He's been extreme and unrepentant in what he's his commentary.
Here's another quote, Melissa. Why was it necessary to disrupt the entire medical system to take care of the needs of 15% of the people? A reference there, of course, to the Affordable Care Act, which he has called the worst thing to happen to the country since
slavery.
Yeah.
Those things are far, far too extreme. And he will paint himself into such a corner that he will not be able to move out of that corner, and his campaign will die on the vine, except for very, very, very scary right-wingers who will support him.
Yeah. Okay. So what happens in those primaries then? Because you were sounding before like those are the kind of issues that turn on primary voters on the Republican side.
the kinds of statements that he makes are so extreme.
More extreme.
They're
than,
so extreme.
Okay, then you would hear from Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah,
and
okay.
not to mention, he really has absolutely no government experience. I know that in some ways that might be a benefit to some candidates, but
right.
for running for the presidency, I think that most voters would like to see at least some record or you know, some sort of legislative record and experience. It's just he's really not electable.
Okay. I think it will be, if he does run, I think it will be a series of very, very significant embarrassments to an otherwise really fine man who's had a wonderful career.
Yeah, I mean, these are cringeworthy comments from people who've read his books and followed his career at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and as a surgeon performing amazing things. So we don't know quite what to make of all of that. Anyway, it sounds like a great ego trip for now for
well, and he's
going to
be right in the middle of a bunch of ego trips.
Yeah.
I mean, and people who know how to use those egos, and I'm not sure that he's, you know, in the proper location.
I wonder if people, I guess the party, this is party establishment. So this isn't Tea Party. The party establishment says you got to elect somebody who is electable.
Yes.
Or else Hillary Clinton becomes president in 2016, right?
I think that's true. And here's the counter argument. So Ted Cruz is going around saying that, well, we can't win this election without people having true conservative convictions. So he points to Ronald Reagan as the model that he'd like to follow. And of course, they point to the failure of Mitt Romney, who was supposed to be the moderate, who was going to be the savior of the party. And he, of course, was a disaster. I think more because Mitt Romney ran a bad campaign and he just wasn't likable. He was so
Absolutely.
Out of touch
okay.
with America.
We left Mitt out of this conversation. A few weeks ago, there were stories buzzing around about Mitt maybe trying it for a third time. Do you think that's possible?
No, I really don't think so.
There are certainly people who want him to.
Yeah.
Whether he wants to himself, I don't know.
That statement, the 47%, I think he'll never recover from that. It really just sort of showed that he was out of touch and someone who really had the best interests, I think, of the wealthiest Americans at heart.
Okay.
Frankly.
Okay. And what about the idea of voting for a third Bush? I've heard this brought up. You know, there's
the Bush Clinton, right?
What, yeah, another,
talk
well,
about
well,
going
we
back
could
to
have
the
a
future.
Bush Clinton thing, right?
But we could.
We could also have a an Ehrlich O'Malley thing. I mean, oh no, you're laughing at me. Don't laugh at me. But when you think about that, it's very interesting that Bob Ehrlich threw his name out there as someone who might be interested in running for president.
I don't see how he can have a viable campaign in the Republican Party. In the first place, he's too easygoing and too nice. He doesn't go after the juggler like a lot of these guys do.
Well, apparently he gave a couple of speeches out of state and people liked him, warmed up to him right away.
Yeah.
Right?
But I just don't think he has the nastiness, if you will, mm-hmm. in him to do what Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and some of these other characters do.
Yeah. Okay.
He reserves that for the press, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't really like the
plus,
sign to remember.
He lost the governorship here twice.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, we may not see that, but in my question about a third Bush, there was George H.W., then there was George W., and if we saw Jeb Bush again, how do Americans going to react to that idea of a dynasty, voting for a dynasty?
I'm not sure.
A generational thing. There are, of course,
right.
you know, there are younger voters today who weren't around when George H.W. ran.
But I think that Jeb Bush at least can run on a pretty successful record and as a Florida governor. And he left office, I think, with fairly high approval ratings. And he's also willing to, I think, to be moderate in a compromise. And I think that quality is sorely lacking in American politics. And so I think he could capitalize on that. And it's sort of a safer, I don't know, maybe it's a comforting name for many people, for many voters. But we'll have to see.
But I think George W. Bush's record would be thrown up at every opportunity if Jeb Bush were to run.
Yeah.
And that record is just horrible.
The sins of the brother. Well, thank you for being here today, Don Norris. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you, Dan.
And congratulations again to the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County on their 40 years there. And Don Norris is the director of that school. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Melissa, nice to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Melissa Deckman, the Lewis L. Goldstein Professor of Political Science at Washington College and Chair of the Department of Political Science there, who joins us from time to time here on Midday. Happy New Year. Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays.
Same to
happy.
You.
Okay. Stay tuned, folks. We've got another hour of Midday coming. I'll open the phone lines up. We can talk about anything you'd like to talk about in the second hour of our show today. We'll follow up a bit on the assassination of police officers in New York City and a couple of other local news stories that we'll talk about. Tuesday's lunch is provided by the Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven thin crust pizza sandwiches, pastas, salads that are made fresh daily. It's open daily, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., with delivery at night, 5 to 9.